Welcome back to the Passion for Craft podcast. Today, we are talking about what Brent wishes he learned at North Bennett Street, kind of. More than anything, we're talking about your time at North Bennett Street and then kind of where you picked up your education afterwards, like the kind of the gaps you needed to fill in, not that it was like...
Yeah.
Like North Bennett taught a lot, but now for someone who's walking out of that into the real world, what did you start... deep diving into and all that kind of stuff.
So I think the thing I learned most there was this level of quality and the level of craftsmanship that
people do this.
Well, people do this well. Mm-hmm. I remember one of the guys said to the teacher, I think I've told this before, putty and paint make us what we ain't.
Yeah.
And the Robert Adam gave him like, don't you ever talk like that in my class or in my presence again. It was one of those things like, ooh.
But in a good way,
right? In that is like, no, we're not doing that. We're not building that way here. And so you get exposed to a whole lot. I remember there was a class on graining wood. They had a specialist come in. I mean, we would sit around and talk about glass, talk about, you know, theory of preservation and everything else. And so there's things that you get experience to
exposure to
and that I think is awesome, right? Worth the trip. Mm-hmm. But, you know, to some of our conversations recently, it's clear that a lot of it came after school.
Yeah.
When I was first out, I was just a trim carpenter. I figured, you know, that I was going to go out and be a trim carpenter.
Like a finished carpenter?
Yeah.
Okay.
And really learned it, and I'm not a business guy, and so it took me a long time to kind of learn how to run a business successfully. And so one of the classes that they've since started is kind of how to run a business, because I know a lot of people get out of school and don't know how to do that. I think that's a great course.
Yeah, it's cool.
I wish I'd understood more about business. I wish I had, you know, just as far as raw skills, you're going to be better when you get out and can practice trimming a few houses. You're going to get better. You're going to get faster. You're going to get better. But I didn't learn that in school. You know, there's a lot of things. I mean, the whole architectural training, I think you'd said they may want us to get back to that and talk about that, but get me back there to talk about that. But I mean, I learned about moldings and molding shapes and things like that much later. And we just did that episode on the pediment. And, you know, the pediment was something I learned way after.
Even if you come in and you teach a like 3-hour class on molding shapes and molding types and you just kind of banter back and forth with the students of the class about that kind of stuff, even that opens your eyes to stuff where you're like, oh, there is stuff to this. Like, there is a reason why you would.
Yeah, I mean, I think it would be really beneficial if everybody went down to Winter Tour and we could walk through historic rooms that way and go, here's a Georgian room, here's a Federal room. Look how these two are different. Look how the moldings are expressed. Look how the shapes change. Look at the decoration in the Federal style versus the Georgian style. There isn't much carving here. There isn't, you know, just all of those different things that you would go, oh, and look at a Greek Revival room. Even just understand the Georgian, Federal, Greek Revival. Where else can you go and learn that stuff except at a place like Winter Tour? So the apprenticeship, I think, sets you up for an expectation of quality, an understanding of preservation, working with hand tools, but you're by no means an expert. And, you know, the whole idea that you're an apprentice and you get out and you work to become a journeyman, you know, I think that's an accurate thing because you just don't know that much. You haven't practiced that much.
I think the other thing is like you get exposed. I know as you're saying this, you get exposed to so much. And then it almost lets you like put your foot in the door of that world to be able to like, I know a couple of these terms to like, I know what you're talking about, but I don't know all of what you're talking about. Help me learn more what you're talking about.
Well, like timber framing, we've talked about that before. I don't.
Ew, yuck.
We don't have much timber framing here in Texas. Yeah. And so I know there's some few firms that do it, but for the most part, timber framing is not a skill that I have.
Yet.
At the same time, I could go, and you could go to a timber framing shop. And because you understand a mortise and tenon and a draw bore and, you know, all the different things of how it goes together, they would hire you because you have a understanding and knowledge of it. and exposure to it,
right,
and exposure of studying the historic craft that most people don't. So, right, I mean, you aren't proficient at timber framing, but you have a lot more than most people do.
For sure.
Am I keeping you awake?
We just ate lunch, so we're it's boring just stuff. Kind of staring at me like, well, I didn't know if you were going to talk more about, you know, some of the stuff you like needed to expound upon. Like, I think you've gone in a route in your career that's different than some of your peers and some of, like, I'm just thinking a lot of my classmates are probably going to go into timber framing. Like, yeah, there's a good 6 of them out of 12, 13 that are really interested in the aspects of timber framing and they're in the right place for it, right? Then there's a good 5 of us, 4 or 5 of us that are interested in finish work and want to know how to like finish out a house. And so we want to do like doors, windows, sill, sash, and then trim. We want to learn how stairs, to do all that stuff. Stairs, yeah.
I remember stairs in particular, understanding, like they kind of screwed us up because one of the teachers says, you know, there's kind of the high level arts of carpentry.
Yeah.
Are boat building, stair building, and curved work, right? Yeah. And so, all of a sudden, we got in our mind, I got to do stairs. Yeah. I got to practice some of these things that are...
You didn't with your last name want to go into boats?
I did not. And so I remember watching videos on stairs. I remember wanting to be a stair builder, but just not having the opportunity to do it. And so that's something, too, that I've done some of, but not a lot of. And yeah, so I think, really, that if you want to get proficient, I was saying this to somebody the other day, that you really... You need to practice preservation work and restoration work, because learning how to, you know, run moldings in a Georgian house, in a Greek Revival house, in a Victorian house, in an arts and crafts house, you're going to run across that. That would be the kind of training that no one has.
Yeah, totally.
Because, you know, they don't do windowsills with aprons and stools and stuff the way they used to. They don't, you know, everything's picture framed out the way they used to do crown, the height of the picture roll, wainscoting are all things that are, you know, historically prominent that aren't practiced today. And so how are you going to get practice?
Yeah.
I mean, this all goes back to that thing where I've told the story about that builder saying, your door's warped. And I go over there and the door isn't warped. It would have been installed wrong.
Yeah.
And when I brought up the fact that it had been installed wrong, the guy said, has he been doing this for 30 years? There's no way that's wrong.
Yeah.
And I'm like, well, I'm sorry. He's been installing doors for 30 years. He hasn't been hanging doors. He hasn't been building doors.
Right.
He doesn't have the depth of experience. And the problem is today, where we are, you know, snap in place building in many cases, stair parts included, kitchens, everything's modular, screwing it to the wall, all the different things. The irony of technology, the better our technology gets, the worse our craftsmanship is, just because you're not required to do as much. Things come pre-finished from the factory.
Yeah. A lot of stuff comes.
A lot of stuff.
Finished from the factory.
I mean, I was telling somebody today, I mean, one of the reasons we have our own mill shop is because I can't get the millwork that I want for our jobs because no one does it.
Yeah. That's hilarious.
Yeah.
You're like, I'm just trying to get a thing that works.
I just want something beautiful in there. Right. I just want this good quality product. Right. And it's hard to get.
Yeah. Learning that you had, was that dictated by some of the machines that you bought, or were you like, I want to, like me leaving North Bennett Street, I'm like, I'm not leaving. I've got another year then change there. So I'm like, whatever. But I'm imagining, oh, in my at home shop, I'd love to have a jointer. I'd love to have a planer. I'd love to have a molder. I'd love to have
my first year there, towards the end of it, about the time you were, I started buying machines.
Yeah.
We had a basement and I had bought a table saw, bought a joiner, bought a planer because I wanted to build my own stuff. So I was going home at the end of the day. We didn't have 4 10-hour days. We had 5 8-hour days.
Yeah.
And so I was getting home at 3:30. You know, I was only 28, so I still had plenty of energy. And so I started building furniture. Then I'd go to school the next day and say, hey, I'm trying to build this cabrio leg and, you know, how do I do it? And the guy would show me. And so I was taking advantage of those teachers to learn as much as I could.
Right.
I was working odd jobs with cabinet companies and things like that. It's pretty funny. North Bennett Street gets, I don't think I've told this story on this.
Usually I know from your first words.
The But North Bennett Street has a really good reputation in Boston, and people will hire North Bennett Street grads to do work.
Yeah.
And students.
Really, in the whole New England area.
Yeah. Yeah. And so there's job boards up there, so you can pick these things. One, somebody wanted a closet added to one of their rooms in their house. Well, I was probably, I don't remember how far, I think it was first year still.
Yeah.
And I went over to these people's house, and they had plaster walls.
Yeah.
And I had to cut a hole through the plaster to get into the other side of the bedroom. And I just took a Sawzall and just all the way down.
Cracking the plaster in the process?
Cracking the plaster and spreading plaster dust everywhere. I mean,
like silica dust?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. They must have gotten home and just been like, what in the hell is going on? And you know, I was clueless. You know, I swept up a little bit. I had no thought that all that dust was going anywhere. I mean, it got into their bed. It got into their stereo. It was like a dust cloud.
They played music the first time that he came back. Just
yeah. And anyway, I was not qualified to do that kind of work. I just didn't have any experience.
Yeah.
So anyway, I learned my lesson, but I still feel bad for those people wherever they are.
Would you have given young you a chance?
Probably to build a piece of furniture. Yeah, I would have did that. To frame an attic out? No.
Yeah.
It wasn't.
But I'm saying your company today, would you hire Brent fresh from North Bennett Street?
Yeah, because the skill I would be hiring is a trim carpenter. I was a good trim carpenter.
Yeah.
So I did a lot of work for other builders here in Fort Worth when I got back. And so guys I competing against today. But no, I did trim work for them.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Cool.
Yeah, I would hire me for that. I wouldn't hire me to, you know, like I said, frame a roof.
Did you want to talk about that guy back there? We can cut it out if not.
Well, I mean, a guy sent me that pediment right there. Basically, it was his calling card. I mean, it sent me a huge box. The box was, you know, 3 feet long, 1 foot tall, 2 feet wide.
Sweet move, by the way. This is awesome.
And he built that up and then sent it to me.
Yeah.
Basically, it was a job offer, right? Job
request.
He wanted me to hire him.
To be clear, most intern request.
Right.
Very like,
I haven't done much.
He's like, I don't know anything, but I watched one of your videos and I figured this out. And I slapped this together.
Well, I mean, to your point, the last pediment video, I mean, that's a pretty good little pediment that this guy's done.
Really good.
And so, you know, this, you know, good.
He's a like 20-year-old. He has to be. Yeah. You know, just given what we don't know. I don't know his age. But I'm just like, that's pretty good. He's starting out, trying to figure it out. He's got a lot of potential. I'm saying you got to hire this guy.
Well, I mean, just give him an internship. Here's the way things work at Hull is that I'm not going to, you got to make this guy work.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
I've got to give it to my team down there at the shop and then say, hey, here's a guy, shows a lot of potential.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, see, let me know what you guys think.
Yeah.
And they look at his resume. He hasn't done much, but.
Well, he's a college kid.
He still hasn't done much.
I know.
So it's just like, do we, you know, hire a guy like that?
Yeah. That's great.
I would probably give him a chance.
Yeah.
But the problem is that a lot of those guys don't work out.
Yeah.
They don't realize how much work it is. They don't realize kind of all that's going on. And so it's not easy.
Been down this road before.
We've hired a number of people before and then most of them don't work out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I look at that and I go, that's the coolest thing you can do. If you want to work for a company, that's how you go about it, I think.
Yeah.
And he's young. He shows potential, you know?
Yeah. I mean, the problem is for me, I look at that and I see all the problems in it and the joints that aren't tight and the things like that. And like, should he have made it perfect and then sent it to me? Or, you know, is this good showing? I mean, that's a complicated piece. He's got the split fillet.
Yeah.
You know, all the hard pieces
high
are
level.
Done.
Yeah.
And so you got to commend him for that.
Yeah, definitely. Anyway, I'm blown away. I think it's really cool. I'm just impressed that, like, I feel like to make a package like that and send it out to someone and, like,
with a cool cover
move.
Letter and a.
It's a great move. Yeah, it's a great look.
That's good.
Just shows you got drive, you know?
Yeah.
Anyway. whoever you are out there, if you're a watcher,
what are you feeling like you're not learning? I mean, if what I wish I had learned at North Bennett Street.
I don't know. I'm just trying to gauge against myself. Like, I'm gauging myself against you. I guess a lot of it, I'm like, when you left North Bennett, you knew everything you know today. That's kind of like a logical fallacy that's going on inside my head. And I know it's not true because I know you continue to learn and I know you continue to read and I know you're constantly trying to up your game. I know that. But I'm looking at the things we're learning at North Bennett Street. Specifically, this pediment thing has been an eye opener where I'm like, okay, I would rather, if I could, if I was like picking, I would rather skip a class on timber framing and go take a class on pediment building. And I would like, if I was able to tailor my class schedule, I would love to go, if someone's doing timber framing work, that's a different skill set and a different like, and we're going to spend 3 months on it. So for me, I'm like, I don't really care enough. But then at the same time, you know, that's one side of my mind. Then at the same time, I'm like, we have Michael Burry, Tom Eldridge, and Sophie, who are all incredible timber framers. So it's kind of like, am I really going to go Leonardo da Vinci? I don't really want to learn about painting. I'd rather do sculpture right. work, you know, because it's a little bit like that where I'm like, well, if I'm there and it's on this curriculum, why wouldn't I want to learn it? But I guess I have such a higher desire to learn other stuff that I'm like, I would budget my time differently probably and like want to learn the basics and learn how to do some of this stuff. But like, I'm not necessarily interested in like the highest level.
I guess I get the sex appeal of the timber frame. And I think you do too. But I don't get the, I mean, it is still framing. Right. Whereas finish work is more beautiful in my opinion.
Yeah.
I would probably be steering you towards building some mantles that I've seen and practicing some of those things than really becoming proficient at timber framing.
Right.
Yeah. But you know, it's a short time you're at North Bennett Street. It goes so fast.
And that's why I'm like, wait, why are we spending a month here? Like, give me an extra month. Like I'll go relief carve for like an extra month. I'll go,
That program, the project you guys do next year with the building the stair, the little half scale thing.
Oh, I forgot we do that. Yeah.
That thing looks
It's unbelievable. Yeah.
I mean, I'm sitting there going, I want to build one.
Yeah.
And so it's a little stair that's probably 4 feet high,
yep.
but it's half scale and you have the tread and the bracket and the balusters and the handrail.
Yep.
It's pretty sexy.
It's really cool.
Treads and risers and everything. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, I'm obviously not a beggars can't be chooser situation. So I'm in a incredible school working with like some of the best of the best. So I'm saying that, but I think in my heart of hearts, I'm like, I'll teach whatever you want to teach me. I'll learn whatever you want to teach me. But I know there is an aspect of the curriculum gets dictated by what the class has interest in. And so there's a little bit of me where I'm just like, can we split the class in half? And like that half, you know, we're working on a house that has timber framing elements to it. Timber frame group A goes and works there, and then finish work B goes and does windows and restores another two windows.
I think the good thing about what you're doing is that you're still using hand planes when you timber frame. You're still using chisels. You're still using those hand skills that you still need to get better at.
Right, right.
And, you know.
Well, and the other thing is timber framing is just joinery on a bigger scale.
Yeah.
And so it is going to make me a better joiner.
Right.
And that's what I'm there for. So I'm going to love it regardless, but I'm, you know, I'm just like, I don't even know. Next year we could get there and they're like, oh, the project that we have in store for you guys is not a timber framing project. It ends up being a this project, you know, and just this year's is a timber frame heavy project. And I know that more of the people are being drawn to the program because of the timber frame, because of Michael Burry, you know? So some of the other like cool things that we learned at North Bend, I'm kind of comparing and contrasting with you.
Sure.
We're going to learn about masonry. Did y'all do a masonry class?
No, we did not. But okay. I think that's an excellent idea.
I'm really pumped about the masonry.
We did some interior plaster work, and that was really interesting.
We're going to do that as well with Penn Bagley?
No, we did. Okay. Robert.
Robert did. Okay, cool. We're going to learn about historic hardware with Robert. He's going to take us through historic hardware. Is there much like you know about historic hardware and like what period had what look and style, or are you just able to be like, it feels federal, you know?
No, I mean because the technology and stuff that was there
it dictated a lot of it,
a lot of that.
Yeah,
yeah, it's really technology driven. It's not until you get post-industrial that you get, you know, the beautiful ornate hardware that, you know, was cast or
right,
things like that.
Oh, cool. The other thing we just had that I was curious, I think I sent you a text on it. Let me just double check because there was a question that I had specifically about it. Historic paint making.
Okay.
Did you guys make any historic paints?
No, we didn't. But, you know, that is a very interesting topic.
What do you guys do for your painting on interiors of houses?
I think we had an historic paint conservator come talk to us about paint and in terms of conservation as opposed to, you know, doing new.
Yeah. Sorry, I meant specifically at Hull.
Oh.
What do you guys do for paint and finish?
Well, I mean...
interior, primarily.
Yeah. We're not usually specifying that. We're specifying the paint on the exterior.
Yeah.
We think a high gloss finish, it lasts longer and things like that. You can't do a matte finish or a eggshell finish exterior, just fall apart.
Yeah.
We've just, as you guys follow me, you know that I started doing the linseed paint and using linseed oils. We use a company called Bruins & Company because I know Mikael Bruins and, you know, the quality of his stuff is really high. And so... we are doing linseed paint, which he says is like Gore-Tex. It allows the paint to breathe. Permeate if through. The wood gets too wet, the vapor can get through, get out. So,
okay, so kind of nerding out on this a little bit.
Yeah.
You got two options when you use linseed oil paint. You can do the raw linseed oil paint, or you can do boiled linseed oil paint. Okay. Do you know which one y'all use?
I think it's an in-between ground because, I mean, true non-boiled linseed oil does never dry.
Right.
So there's got to be dryers in it and things like that. But but I don't think it's a true boiled linseed oil.
Okay.
And so it's, I remember, because I asked them that.
Yeah, there's a lot of like cool specifications that go through it. Like if you use raw linseed oil, you need to cut it with turpentine. Mm. And the turpentine draws it into the wood.
Mm.
And then you're mixing a pigment into the linseed oil.
Right.
So we just made our own paints recently.
Nice.
And you take a pigment and you... crush it up as you are putting it into the linseed oil. So it like ingrains them together basically. And then when it goes in the wood, the wood sucks it into itself and it leaves that layer of...
Well, when I did the first video on linseed paint, some people have not had a good experience. And Mikael's comment was that if it didn't have the right dryers and stuff like that, or the linseed oil wasn't good quality, it can actually spoil.
Yeah.
And so I think that you have to get a good quality. But and he also said that the mixing that they do is much more old school.
Yeah.
And they're using, you know, recipes from the 1780s and 1820s.
Right.
So it's crazy.
Some of the really wild stuff with linseed oil paint is, sorry, it's a total paint tangent, but I think it's really cool. What's George Washington's house?
Mount Vernon.
Mount Vernon, that one. So in Mount Vernon, they had someone come and do a paint analysis on their paint. So they take a little droplet of paint that they've found somewhere, usually like behind a crack or something where paint has seeped in, and then there'll be a low UV. So they'll take a little sample of it. They'll put it under a microscope and they'll zoom it in like 200, 400 times. And you see like a tectonic plate layers, like all the levels of paint. But then when you look close enough, you can actually see the pigments of the paint that are mixed into the paint to figure out what blend they used to match the color to historic. At Mount Vernon, they painted one room that they had mixed and matched and gone from the thing. It changed the color of the room to like this pearl green, like a disgusting like snot green almost. And they're like, what? What happened? Well, when they first did their first stroke of paint, it looked exactly like it was going to do, like this nice baby sky blue. And then as they continued to paint it, it stretched the pigment further and further apart. The question was like, why did it stretch the pigment? Well, with newer pigment crushing technologies, not mortar and pestle, not, you know, how they would have done it, like they would have used a stone and they would have ground it in like this, it's almost a trough. And a big stone, and they just roll that stone back and forth across the trough. And that was how they would grind pigments. Well, when doing that, you wouldn't finely grind it like you would if you had like a modern machine doing it. So it would have some pigments that were just tiny specks, and then some that were like bigger specks. Anyway, when you brush that across, because they disperse differently, the color that's reflected back at you is completely different. Hmm. So anyway, they were like, okay, well, we got to blend it this way. We got to change the thing. So they've done a lot of cool, like paint analysis is awesome. And
Alice is a big fan of paint analysis. I do think there's good science there, but
it's really cool. Anyway, so one of the advisors to the program is a paint analyst. And so she was helping us explain that. Anyway, total side note, total nerd out, but very cool.
That's an example of this thing that you get exposed to at North Bennett Street you're never going to exposed to otherwise. And so that, to me, I think infuses your education and makes you have a depth of understanding that other people don't have.
One of my classmates was asking if you use linseed oil paints inside at all, because
we don't.
The girl said, don't use linseed oil paints on cabinets or counters, wherever. Because it takes like 2 weeks to dry, sometimes you get a stickier surface feel.
We've seen that on the outside.
And so you got to beeswax it, coat it in beeswax, and that's kind of what makes it have that nice sheen to it.
Interesting, I didn't know that.
And so that's ultimately the final finish. So we're going to be doing that to our cabinets, is we're going to do linseed oil paint, and we're going to finish it with
beeswax. That's cool.
It'll be really cool. But one of the reasons it's necessary is because what you're saying about the drying process and everything, there's apparently a Swedish company that does it, and when they do it, they boil the linseed oil and then filter it, and then boil it and filter it, and boil it and filter it, and it gets rid of the sugars, the extractives, and everything that's going to ultimately decay and spoil. So it leaves behind this really pure process, but obviously more time, more money in the boiling and extracting of everything makes it to where that's not like the most inexpensive paint in the world, but it does last for years.
Yeah.
And it's way better than the latex paint because, like you're saying, it breathes. Well, so it doesn't crack an alligator.
People can't get their heads around something that lasts a long time versus something that's quick and easy.
Like,
and
the cost value of it, or like the...
Everything. The everything. Cost of it, the finding the right person who actually knows what they're doing.
Yeah.
You know, it I was telling somebody the other day of getting prepared to fight, okay?
Yeah.
Actually, I was giving a talk somewhere. Where was I just giving a talk?
And to the ACU students.
No, it was somebody else. It was...
it's really important that you remember
it this. Is. It, now it's bugging me. Yeah. Anyway. Oh, I know where I went. I went to Dufuniac Springs, Florida.
I was going to say the same thing. I should have said it.
And in Dufuniac Springs, I was telling them how they need to fight, because all these people were... having challenges. I had a guy who the building code inspector required that he change his windows or get it throughout his fireplace because it wasn't the code. I had another one. The insurance came along and said, you have to foam your house, because if you don't foam your house, we're not going to insure it. All of these different things that are beating you up. And I said, well, don't forget too, your builders are going to go, why aren't we just tearing this off and putting on Hardy? Or why aren't we, you know, why would we do this? This is a lot more work, because they're not used to doing that. And that fight is, I think, maybe your that understanding and your, you know, emotional intelligence and ability to work through that could be the most important thing that you do as a contractor, as a builder, is helping people fight, because everybody's against them. They go to the lumberyard and they say, do you have just regular wood siding? No one uses wood siding anymore.
Right.
You need to use, everybody uses Hardy. Well, everybody? Well, gosh, if you really did want to get that, we could special order it. It costs a ton. You know, just discourage. And then the builder shows up and he says, well, I've never done that. I don't think anybody does that. And if you're not
willing to say
and with the conviction to say, this is the way we're doing this way, this is what's going on.
If you don't,
know what the hell you don't know what you're doing, right?
The heck you're doing.
And I'm, you know, if you don't fight, you can end up with a real mess.
Yeah. Fighting is such an interesting concept. I don't like when you use that word. Remember when someone said that? A lot of people said that. A lot of people didn't like the word fight.
Oh, is that right? I kind of forgot that.
Remember? Yeah, remember we read all the comments and everyone was like, you don't have to fight for it.
You know? You do have to fight. And I will go back to the mat on that.
Yeah.
I
mean, you'll fight for that.
I will fight for that. That is absolutely true.
Yeah, no, it's really interesting, because a lot of times the answer, this is true throughout life, I feel like, the answer is never no. the answer is more like, that's going to cause me a layer of friction that I don't really want to deal with. So I'm going to tell you no. And then if you really fight for it, we'll figure something out. And so, or you really push for it, you really, or, you know, threaten to go to somewhere else. And then maybe you do have to go to someone else. Maybe you, that's the fight, is you're like, I want it done this way. It's going to be done this way. And if it's not going to be done this way by this person, I'm going to go to someone else. And then, but a lot of times people hear that and go, well, if they can't do it, I'm just not even going to push because this is my normal guy. This is who does my stuff. Right. This is who, but if you're like, no, I want to do it different.
But I think,
be better.
I think the reason I got on this train is because, you know, I'm hearing you learn about kind of the finer, you know, history and background with paints and things like that, that makes you more informed, that allows you to basically have an opinion and basically go, no, that's not the way we're going to do this.
Right.
Most people don't have that background and that ability to do that. And I want you to
fight more people.
Hold on to that. I'm trying not to use the word fight. Hold on to that and you know,
stand my ground.
Educate people, right, mm-hmm. on what the proper way to do things is.
Yeah. I agree. It was Kevin who was big on the interior linseed oil paint. I think there is so much merit to applying it with a coat of beeswax. Did that work? Nice. Well, basically, we have felt Steve's cabinet, and like we're all handling it, and we're trying to like figure it out and all this stuff. And it's been on the wall, and it's funny just how everything's presented, because Steve painted it with linseed oil paint 20 years ago. That when he made it, it was 21 years ago that he made this cabinet, and he applied a layer of beeswax coating over it, and Kevin and I were looking at it and we were like scratching it and we were like trying to like feel it and trying to like penetrate this layer that's been made between this linseed oil paint and the beeswax. And when we're scratching it, not a scratch is being left behind, nothing is looking poor on this thing. And so we're just like, okay.
Why aren't we using this today?
Yeah. We're like, Steve, you have to treat this regularly with beeswax. He goes, yeah. And we're like, okay, how regularly? Like, when was the last time you treated this? And we're expecting, like, last year, I put a layer of paint in it. He goes, when I made it 20 years ago, I put a layer of beeswax over it. I'm like, and it still looks like this? He's like, well, it's bumped up, it's beat up. And he's right, it is bumped up, it's beat up. But on every chip, every corner that's been banged, the paint has stayed with the material unbelievably well. And it's not peeling away. It's not in 20 years. It hasn't been touched.
I bet,
but it's been handled.
There are 20 products like this that could be ready to go and change the building market, but we're ignoring them.
It's the craziest thing in the world, because if you think about that, 20 years, how many times are you gonna have to repaint a pair of cabinets for 20 years worth of whatever? And then it's linseed oil, so what you're touching is a permeable layer to the wood. Like, it breathes. Water can get into it, out of it. Like, water doesn't, because it's oil and there's oil sitting in that barrier. But the stuff can move in and out of it. The wood can move. It can expand. The wood expands in the summer. It doesn't cause cracks in the paint. It can contract in the winter. It doesn't cause cracks in the paint. Because it's an oil that is soaked and sitting in the thing. It's like, what? And then exteriorly, like, if you have linseed oil paint on an exterior, your treatment process is rub a little linseed oil paint on it and it revitalizes the stuff. Maybe the pigment dies out a little bit to the UV colors, but add one more layer of linseed oil paint on it and it's done. It's good to go. And you buy linseed oil paint, it's so concentrated, you're buying so much less of it and it covers so much more. A jar this big
that
will cover our cabinet.
That the gallon costs twice as much, but it goes three times the as far.
Right.
So it's like
the math is a no-brainer. It's just not what people are used to.
It's not what people are used to.
But also, I think because lead came in the way, lead was so much better. Like, if you're talking what is the best material out there, it's probably lead. Like, or at least
right.
A lot of my professors are like, because I asked Michael Burry, I was like, what would you use like in an ideal world, like paint wise for this exterior? Because we just went to this paint thing and I saw Michael. I was like, what would you use? And he goes, lead, 10 times out of 10. I was like, no, I meant like latex based or.
Yeah.
And he was like, no, I would use lead, but we can't. And right. I was like, oh, so lead is like the king.
Right.
But obviously you don't want poison.
Yeah. I think there's 20 products like this that were, that if you thought about it,
yeah,
like if longevity and sustainability are really truly what people want,
yeah,
we're building with the wrong products.
Totally.
I mean, we just are. And so it's because of the mass thing that they can make it in a factory and, you know, spit out it by the mile.
But even still, you can make linseed oil paint in a factory. Like yeah. That one, if you
the problem there is the learning curve. You know, the painter learning curve that
they're not going to be able to aerosol it. They're going to have to hand brush it. Is that
that's part of it.
That's it.
But they had when they did our front door, they had to build it up three times or four times, and you wouldn't have to do that with normal paint because people look at the coverage thing as being, oh, I want to make sure I get good coverage. Yeah. I don't want to have to paint it twice,
mm-hmm.
right? With linseed, we're going to paint it four times, and it's, yeah. Right?
We're going to paint it four times, and you're never going to have to touch it for 20 years, exactly. Maybe more, you know?
Well, and that's a real tester of a door because that's a black door.
On an exterior.
On a western exposure in Texas.
Yeah.
You know?
That's going to be the tester.
I'm not sure there could be a worse condition for the door.
Yeah. It could be, black is going to be, it's going to fade in the, yeah, perfect. That's perfect.
So we'll see. It's in year one of that coverage.
And but I mean, great shape.
I just think there's 1,000 products like that.
Yeah.
And that we just, because it's just like we don't eat healthy. Why? Because ding dongs are so easy to get.
Yeah.
They're everywhere. I can go to, you need fruit and vegetables. What? Yeah, where am I going to get fruit and vegetables?
And I can't go to Costco and buy 30 fruits for the entire, week. I have to, go weekly to go pick up stuff. That was a difference in France culture. There's no easy restaurants nearby. You're either sitting down at a restaurant or you're...
There's no convenience store kind of thing.
Correct. There's one in huge radius. Anyway, maybe in Paris it's a little different. But even still, it was like the culture was go sit, eat a full meal, enjoy, you're there for an hour, guaranteed, or go to a store, buy your raw food, fruit, veggies, meat, everything. And typically it wasn't go to one store. It was go to one store, buy your fruit, go to another store, buy your bread, go to another store, buy your meat.
Well, and then the Preta manager, right? Is a good sandwich shop that's fairly quick, right?
Yes.
That's fast food.
Right. Anyway, there's a cultural difference there that I think harkens back to their culture of building and I think we have the same problem.
And the other problem is that we celebrate fast, we celebrate cheap, and we don't celebrate
long
healthy, right? Mm-hmm. And so it's a problem.
Anyway, so that's a big tangent on
yes it is.
Okay, so I thought of this while we were doing the historic paint making lecture. Lee Noel Chase was this girl who came and taught us all of our historic paint making. She said something that was like, why don't we do this in every house? And I'm about to change the game for you, okay? You ready? No, I'm just kidding. But I do think it's a good idea, almost like a black box for a house, if you will.
Okay.
So maybe it's a binder, maybe it's something else, but it has every single molding profile that you used on the original house. It has every single, and I know there's blueprint plans that can be part of that, but just being able to source something is really hard. And so if you have the blueprints, you don't necessarily have the access to everything, but even the paint colors, this might already be a thing. I'm kind of saying it and I'm like,
no,
everyone does this.
No, we're trying to get to the point where we are handing off a binder at the end of the job, explaining everything we did. It takes more work.
Totally.
And it's not easy, but I think it's incredibly valuable because you put paints, you put tile, you put all those things that you did, alarms,
sprinkler systems,
all that stuff.
So the other thing that I thought would be really cool about it is you have slots put in for renovations, additions, and other stuff to where it's like, if you change anything, here's the change log. So we put in a new set of trim here. I'm just going to take a little piece of that trim and then stencil it in. And then go, okay, now this is on this west wall. I don't know. Maybe that's dumb. Maybe that's overkill. But I just keep thinking with all these historic homes that we have, if someone had just kept some sort of detailed record and followed along, we would have think about all the stuff we lost with Vitruvius, like where he came and like rewrote all the stuff that we've lost. Think about like those kind of things where it's just like,
yeah, I don't know. We're going to get into a culture. I don't know what you're going to end up with is a bunch of product listings. And I don't think you're going to have technique or you're going to have, you know, theory or you know, how to build a pediment in there. I think that you might end up with, these are the moldings we used on your pediment, but there's not, I don't think we're remembering the past that way.
That might be a historic preservation.
Well, historic preservation world. Wise, that on an historic house, you're supposed to be documenting things. You're supposed to be, and when we worked on Thistle Hill and McFarland, you know, we put in a new roof, we backstamped all the backside to let people know when we installed it and stuff like that.
Well, and that's the good stuff. Like, that's also, I don't know. I guess that's just living in a fantasy world in some sense, because I think part of it is
some people that are, I think, would really appreciate that.
Yeah. But also, it kind of is presumptuous, I guess, to be like, my house is going to last 50 years. Uh-huh. And when someone looks at my house in 50 years, they're going to be so grateful that I put together this.
I think, you know. Yeah, that's interesting.
And I'm also imagining, you remember that room that we talked about where all of your plumbing goes to this one room, all of your electricity, and like that's your command console. I'm imagining just like a, you know, 2x2 room or 3x3 room that is at the center, like the core of your house, on a pedestal in the middle, there's this binder with all, you know, I'm kind of fantasizing it a little bit, because as a preservationist, it'd be so nice to just be like, oh, let's just go check what they originally did.
And I think that, you know, I do a lot of sleuthing in my videos, and I think that I do that because once you've seen all of that stuff, you begin to start recognizing it. They added this tile in the 50s. They did this. See, that door is hollow core. We know that's after this time. Look at the hardware. It's from this time.
I also think the thing that like kind of made me spur on this like thing is George Washington kept a record. You know, maybe it wasn't George Washington.
No, I think he did.
He kept a record. He was like, this was our painter.
Yeah.
This was our so-and-so. This is what they did. Like, and it was almost like a, like,
I think Thomas Jefferson did the same thing.
Yeah, he did. I know he did. But I've seen it in a couple of other places as well, where they had these lists running where you're like, and today we're like, oh, and we know that George Washington was using a paint company out of Pennsylvania and was using a, you know, and then you can kind of cross-reference and go, oh, we've heard about this Pennsylvania paint company.
I wonder what the age is that becomes so valuable, right? Is it 50 years, 100 years, 150 years?
When do they get officially stamped into, like, it's a historic house now in Texas? 50
years.
So it could be kind of a cool, I don't know, you're on the Historic Preservation Society of Fort Worth, right?
I have been, not now.
Well, it could be a cool standard to just go, you need to make a book, you need to make a write-up of your house to say what you know of it so far, when additions were added and other stuff in order to be in the system.
I would think that, No, that's a good idea.
Because also, if that becomes some sort of practice in anyone's life, then it kind of automatically makes your mentality towards building a home, I'm trying to make this thing last at least 50 years.
Well, I think that, you know, I think that's a huge deal. If you could get people to start seeing things that way, that would be a big deal.
Because I think the other thing too is, like, if someone hands me a binder that's like plastic, you know, just the cheap one they got at Walmart that you get, like, back to school binder, and they're like, here you go. And in a couple of years, I know there's going to be plastic ripped off the front cover of it, and it's going to be tattered or whatever. I'm kind of like, cool, thanks. You know, but then if someone gives me like a bound, you know, not bound necessarily, but you know what I mean? Like a nicer.
Ours is a leather book.
Yeah, that's so cool. Yeah. Right? Like, now you're all of a sudden like,
the problem is you don't need it for the first 10 years.
Yeah, you're 100% right.
So they look at it like,
It goes in a box somewhere.
10 years later, they go,
where was that?
Wait, didn't they do that for us? And so, it's a good idea. It needs to happen, but I think it's.
I think part of it, I was kind of like, we're in the modern era. We could do like a jump drive that has all that stuff on it.
We do. We have the whole job, all the bills we paid, who we paid it to, on a jump drive that we give to them.
That's cool
so
too.
They do have that information and all their budget stuff. They care more about that stuff than they do about, you know, where the molding and trim came from. And I think for us, they would say, well, Brent did the house. He must have made the moldings.
Right.
Which sometimes we
sometimes
did.
Sometimes you do, yeah. I don't know. I guess in my mind, I'm kind of like thinking about you know, in an ideal world, I get to come work for you someday. And so I'm lucky. Yeah, I got to show promise. But yeah, so I guess part of me, I'm always like, what can we do for our clients? Like, if we build a home, what's that cool hull stamp that we put on it, other than it being a beautifully designed home?
Yeah, and, like, I know that there's some companies that have put a little marker on their house. Like
a plaque almost?
Yeah, hull built. Or problem is, a lot of the builder who I can think of who did that is kind of chintzy. And so
I don't know what that word means, but I get your vibe.
Well,
I
they get just, what you're saying. They're kind of, it isn't the best house. And so it's a marketing ploy, not a we're proud of our craftsmanship ploy. Mm-hmm. And so,
and maybe they are proud of their craftsmanship. So show credit where credit's due.
Could be, but, So anyhow.
Yeah.
Yeah. Good stuff. Keep thinking about stuff like that. We need it.
Yeah. I've been, you know, just down in the dumps ever since last time I came up with a $1 million idea. Remember the R value, but for house longevity?
I forgot about that.
You remember that?
Yeah. That was a great idea.
See, right? Everyone, you heard it here first. No, we were talking about that on the last time Richard came by, that was like, you know, just a brilliant idea and like really smart. We were talking about it because, you know, it's something that can elevate the game and change the way we think about building. And so just trying to change things for the better.
Yeah, this is what I'm about.
That's what I do.
That's who I am. That's who I am. I can't help myself.
Anyway, thanks for watching this episode of the Passion for Craft podcast, and we'll see you on the next one.